to the Paula Gordon Show. I'm Paula Gordon. People travel everywhere today. There's an increasing threat that they're carrying unwanted baggage, viruses. Our guest is Dr. C.J. Peters, Chief of Special Pathogens at the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, in Atlanta. Dr. Peters is deeply concerned that we don't recognize the danger of viruses. He's worried about viruses we once thought were conquered and about new viruses which are emerging. Dr. Peters is not an alarmist, but he does want us to wake up to the twin threats of wild viruses and threats from terrorists who could very easily use viruses with disastrous effectiveness.
There is a problem out there that you should be able to sleep at night, but when you wake up, you ought to worry just a little bit, and you ought to get some insurance. I mean, the guys
insurance who, like what?
Well, insurance like surveillance, research, the counterterrorist effort, not begrudge the military the means that they need to go on and develop their countermeasures against biological warfare as well as chemical and nuclear. In other words, some of these problems we can nip earlier rather than later.
Dr. Peters is a medical doctor who has also worked with the Army and the U.S. Public Health Service. For 30 years, he's battled hot viruses all over the world. Dr. Peters led the team that contained the outbreak of Ebola in Reston, Virginia, just one of the very scary stories he tells in his book, Virus Hunter. Virus Hunter is a heck of a good read about an important subject. So Bill Russell and I invited Dr. Peters and a select group of people to join us at the Commerce Club in downtown Atlanta. As you may hear, the Commerce Club was a very busy place that night. Dr. Peters, we talk a lot on this program about living in a time of great change. Well, it turns out, as you describe viruses, they're sort of the champions of change. They know how to do that. They're quite adaptable. Before we go get off into all of the wonderful things you have to talk about, tell us about viruses. Viruses, to most people, are things you get a sniffle, you feel poorly, and then you get better. Tell us what's a virus so that we can then talk about all the things that are involved with being a virus.
I think it's great just to start with the basics because a lot of people don't realize how different viruses are from most other life forms. They're not even really alive in one sense. I mean, they're just a piece of genetic code, which, as you know, could be RNA or DNA. That piece of genetic code is wrapped in some kind of envelope that protects it from the environment and also serves to dock with cells that they can infect.
Dock?
Dock, like, you know, like a ship docks.
Like clicking in, huh?
Or, yeah, like your portable computer docks with your home station or, you know, mirror docks with this and that.
Okay.
So they have to be protected, and then they have to get inside cells. And that outer coat is part of what protects them, or it's all of what protects them, because the nucleic acids are very sensitive to being torn up. And that also determines where they're going to dock, because they can dock better with some cells than others. And that coat is what determines their docking potential.
Yeah, they sound fragile.
They are, but there's lots of them. I mean, they have one of these strategies for reproduction, unlike elephants with a very long gestation period and few offspring. They're more like ants, or taken even further than ants. They have a very short gestation period and many, many, many offspring. Mm-hmm. And you just hope that one or a few of them will make it someplace.
Their job is to replicate, yes?
But the key thing is that they have to keep going. And if they don't, then they're gone. They die out. And this swarm strategy is useful to them because of their rapid turnover and because they mutate frequently when they replicate. In other words, they don't replicate as faithfully as we do when our genome turns over.
So they don't keep their same genetic makeup of what, 7,
well,
8, 9, 10, 12?
Less than, it's a little, the emphasis is a little different. This may seem overly subtle, but I think it's really important. They're mutating, these mutations in general will not be very helpful to them in a given environment. But if they change their environment and their other demands for survival, then these mutations give them the opportunity to survive.
So like if they started out living in monkeys and wanted to go live in humans,
there would probably be changes as they would adapt and become more efficiently ensconced in the human race.
Do viruses make something sick? Is that always what a virus does?
No, they don't have to make anything sick at all. But they can't grow by themselves. So they infect a cell in some host. And, you know, there are animal viruses and plant viruses. Even bacteria have viruses.
Hmm.
So they infect a cell, and they have to take over that cell. And sometimes they take over the cell in a very subtle way. And, hey, there may be some changes that we don't even catch on to. I mean, that cell may get older faster or so on, but it may not have any overt changes. Or it may have some very obvious changes in function and not work right. Or the virus can just blow it away. It depends on the virus-cell interaction.
You know, I was thinking about this, trying to sort of work my way into thinking like a virus. And it's not hard. It is not guaranteed that a virus will survive, or that a virus will win, but they're almost guaranteed not to lose, which is a powerful tool. And I'm really thinking from the evolutionary standpoint, they are going to find a niche one way or another just by that sheer replication, aren't they?
That seems to be the case. And we certainly have a lot of diversity in viruses. I mean, they're just part of life. I mean, we shouldn't think of them as just diseases. They're part of life. And some of them are not harmful at all to their host, and they only make trouble when they get over into another host.
We're going to come back in just a minute with Dr. C.J. Peters, who is the chief of special pathogens at the CDC. We're going to talk about viruses. We're going to talk about what viruses do and what they don't do, and there are lots of implications for where we are and where we're going. Please stay with us. Bill Russell and I are here at the Commerce Club with invited guests, and one of those guests is Dr. C.J. Peters. We'll be right back. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Our guest is Dr. C.J. Peters, and we're talking about viruses. You were just saying viruses aren't necessarily a sickness issue. They're simply part of life. Well, I'm more important than a virus because I'm a human. So how can you say that I'm an equal to a virus?
Yeah, I think it's a big mistake to assume that we're the center of the universe and we're always going to be here. I think all you have to do is look at some of the people who have thought deeply in the past and who are thinking deeply today about evolution. Guys who are writing in this area, The Sixth Extinction, A Full House, some of these books, I think put it into a very nice perspective. And if that's not good enough, well then just look around you and see how quickly things are changing. I think we may be the last big mammal, because we seem to be able to screw up the earth so thoroughly that there may be a little period here after us where there's all kinds of problems with the existence of the planet. But that's not what we're here to talk about, and that's not I know anything about.
And it's also important to say in your point, which you make in your wonderful book, The Virus Hunter, there are only 4,000 mammals, give or take, on the planet, and we are just one of that 4,000, and other life forms have done real well, and that all of these life forms together, they all have a stake in this, which takes us back to you being a virologist. That's hard to say.
Did
I say
virologist?
Virologist. Okay.
So hard.
You're
to
not
say.
Viral. You're a viral. I got it.
I want to go
something
back.
That little this, having that big an impact on the big guys.
Well, and the ability
impresses me
to know that you're not going to lose. I mean, that is a striking. If you could go
well,
and
I mean,
if
they
you could
may,
go
does
in
the virus
and,
know
they may
anything?
Lose. I'm sure that sometimes they lose, just like
well, individually, yes, but there's not much reason to believe they're going to lose collectively, is there?
Not collectively as viruses, but a viral species may
sure.
extinguish itself.
Sure.
I mean, I think that probably happens. Unfortunately, they don't leave fossils, so we can't go back and dig them up and say, aha, you know, this dinosaur had a virus. Well, all we can find are his bones.
That's very interesting. There's no history. The history that we have of viruses is essentially the modern history then.
We have some information from 5,000 years ago that indicates clearly there were viruses then, but that's not long. And we have, for example, pharaohs' mummies, which show skeletal deformities that mean that they had poliovirus infection, almost certainly. We have a mummy or two that has smallpox scars, and some people even think they've been able to visualize smallpox virions. Smallpox is a virus, and the virion is its little body. Been able to visualize those in scrapings from the embalmed skin of those pharaohs. But that's all we have, except just the general feeling that these things just don't happen. They've been around.
Yeah. Is it a fair fight between us and them?
Well, I think it's a fair fight. They've got, on their side, they've got this replicated potential we talked about, this evolutionary potential. They've got all this going for them. Plus, there's lots of different kinds of them. And we've got our brains. And if we can just get smart enough and pay attention to what they're doing, I think we can give them a run for their money. But unless we're looking out, I think we have a problem.
Are we looking out?
Well, until the 60s, infectious diseases in general were seen as a major threat. People in this country who are older remember the real problems with polio, diphtheria, all these older infections that have caused such problems. But in the 60s, we began to get on top of the existing infections, and we began to develop not just one antibiotic like penicillin or sulfonamides, but multiple antibiotics. And we thought we had it won. And I think at that point, people stopped looking out. And in the last 5 years, we've just turned around and said, hey, wait a minute. We're going through our antibiotics faster than you can imagine.
Going through them, like making them ineffective, right?
We're using them, misusing them, and overusing them to the point where they're not able to treat the infections that we could 20 years ago. I mean, it's easier to treat some infections when I was an intern than now. And similarly, we're seeing that the ecological change, I mean, you made the point that this program talks about change. Well, that change for a virus means opportunities, you know, and that's exactly the kind of attitude that we've begun to realize we're going to have to take. And people are now actually putting money into CDC and other organizations to go out and find out what's happening. We call it surveillance. That's the $5 word, surveillance. But really, it just means poking your nose around and trying to figure out what is happening in the disease world.
Is that what epidemiologists do? There's another one of those 75-cent words. Epidemiologists go out and look at epidemics, yes?
Well, that's the old definition, but now we tend to see it much more broadly. They measure what's happening so they can recognize epidemics. Also, I'm not really an epidemiologist. I don't have a degree I don't know the secret handshake and so on. I do a lot of epidemiology. And I think one of the things that we're trying to do is to bring together microbiology, epidemiology, and the other sciences that fit in, sociology and so on and so on. So, I mean, it's not a simple problem. It's not, you don't send an epidemiologist out who tells you how to prevent disease. You don't send a microbiologist out who makes a vaccine. You don't send a social scientist out to tell you how they can live better in this particular area and avoid disease. You need all the disciplines together.
I've been struck just reading your book and other things at the subtlety of what you're dealing with and the complexity of it. It's not as if, I mean, we all have the sense, at least I have the sense, that there's a certain mechanical process. You know, you plug it in here, you turn the crank, and the answer comes out.
Sounds like a good idea, don't you think, Dr. Peters?
And that they're readily established. If you spend enough years in school, then you know how to do that. Or if not, you call up somebody who does. And it seems to be much more complex than that, much more subtle than that.
Wouldn't be any fun if that's all you did. I mean, you know, if you went out, I'll admit that when you go out on these epidemics, you frequently run by the library and Xerox a few things and read them on the airplane. But at the same time, you have a creative process and you have an information gathering process. I mean, you arrive on the scene and you don't know what's happening. there are rumors, there are stories, the things in the press. You can't actually believe any of those. You have to find some of the principals. You have to start talking to the principals and finding out what really happened.
You mean like the people principals?
Yeah, yeah, sorry.
So that you can develop a principal, yes?
The principals, ALS, to develop the LES. And that's,
this sounds like a detective story.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in it, except you, and you also have forensics.
Forensics.
I mean, we take things back to the lab. I mean, somebody dies, and what we would like to do.
You mean like police forensics? Forensics?
No. I by analogy, forensics. Oh, we like to carve them all up in little pieces and take them back to our equivalent of the medical examiner.
Uh huh. And what do they do?
We have techniques now in pathology and in microbiology to probe these tissues to look for viral genomes. We can look for the genetic material of viruses.
So somebody gets sick and you cut them up and take it back and look at the things that made them sick?
In the worst case, we like to think that we wouldn't do that unless they died first. But when those are the kinds of sicknesses.
I think I was thinking biopsies, but okay.
we'll settle for biopsies sometimes. But you can take the techniques of modern pathology, and that's a problem in our country, by the way. We're not doing autopsies the way we used to.
Huh. Why is that?
No, it's bucks. It's bucks. Managed care. Who wants to pay for somebody else's autopsy, and what is it going? How is that autopsy going to benefit the insured? Well, the insured's dead, so it's not going to benefit them at all. Forget it. So
we don't know what's killing people. We don't know as much as we used to about what's killing people.
Less and less. We were lucky in the Hanavirus outbreak in that it happened
in the what virus outbreak?
There is an outbreak that I talk about in the book that's caused by a virus called a Hanavirus. It occurred in the Southwest in 1993. It was a brand new disease.
Among the Navajo people.
People were dying, particularly Navajo. And as these people died from this terrible disease that literally causes them to drown in their own plasma, as they died, no one knew what was going on. And the more people who died, the less we knew about what was going on, the more we were sure it was something different. And one of the big keys to resolving it was that the state of New Mexico has a law that says that the Office of Medical Investigations can require an autopsy if there's reason to suspect that there's an importance for public health.
Which is non-trivial with the Navajo.
It's non-trivial with the Navajo, and it's non-trivial even with non-Navajo.
Because there
right.
are cultural prescriptions against doing autopsies.
As well as the economic problem.
Among the Navajo. Right. But I can tell you it's difficult even in an Anglo group to get autopsies when you need them.
We're going to be back in just a minute with Dr. C.J. Peters, who's going to talk about hantaviruses and this whole very complex issue of emerging new diseases at a time when we are deceiving ourselves, I think you would say, that we've conquered infectious diseases. Lots to talk about. Bill Russell and I are here at the Commerce Club with Dr. C.J. Peters, and we're going to be back in just a moment. Do stay with us. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are talking with Dr. C.J. Peters. We are talking about the fact that viruses aren't real picky about who they go after, are they?
No, that's one of the very democratic things about these bugs. There are some viruses that are viruses of different social classes and different habits and so on, but there's a virus for everybody. And I think one of the examples, we were talking about this Hantavirus situation just before the break, and we discovered this virus in the Southwest. It seemed to be disproportionately a disease of the Navajo people. But then it turned out it wasn't because they were Navajo. It was because they were rural, and the rural dwellers, Anglo, Hispanic, Navajo, were the people who were being affected. And now we've discovered that in certain areas, the very richest people are at risk from these diseases. We had
we had
a case in Long Island shortly after we discovered the virus, because the person who was infected owned a very nice, very large house with beautiful grounds around the house, a wonderful place for the little rodents that carry the virus to live. And when it started getting cold, they came into the house because they wanted to get warm and have a little chow, I assume, and bingo. So these viruses are really equal opportunity.
When we're looking at the world with an increasingly large human population, many of whom live in places that can't afford the crowding, that they're already pretty crowded, don't we up the odds of epidemics? Let me just get right to the point here. When we've got an exploding human population, don't we as a species put ourselves at risk for things like viruses?
No, I think it's a terrible problem. And I think it is more than just the direct effects. There are indirect effects also. Take, for example, the mega cities. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a direct effect. More people crowded together so that there are more opportunities for viruses to adapt to spreading from person to person. But the other things that go with the megacities, if your population is growing faster than your gross national product, then you have a situation where those megacities are not going to have the sanitation they need. They're not going to be able to afford that sanitation. This is going to press on the food supply. That means there's going to be more irrigation projects. What are the irrigation projects going to lead to? More problems with mosquito control, changes in the environment so that when we clear forest and plant cereal crops, we're going to have an ideal condition for rodents, which can also bring viruses. And then with all this pressure on the water supply to irrigate and to feed these, to irrigate the crops and to feed the people, we're going to leave less and less opportunities for disposal of waste. We're going to make it harder and harder to use chemicals to control these insects and so on. And we're going to also get into a corner with viruses of plants. There are two different groups of plant viruses that are extremely important today. And these viruses are going to be one of the limits to the Green Revolution. We're going to have to continually be dealing with the viruses of plants to be able to sustain our style of agriculture. In other words, what we like to do is we get something that grows very well. Maybe we've got to put a lot of fertilizer in and so on and so on. But basically, we're going to get a very high yield. And it's going to be one kind of wheat or rice or corn. And we're going to plant it as far as the eye can see. And it's going to be resistant to some diseases and susceptible to others. So when a disease comes along that it's susceptible to, it's going to go through it very quickly.
Sounds like the potato famine.
This is the 150th anniversary of the Irish potato famine. You probably know the story better than I do, but there are more than 300 varieties of potatoes in South America. Sure, if you're an Andean Indian and you're living close to the bone and the blight comes and gets one of your potato varieties, you're going to suffer.
You've got 299 left.
But there's going to be others left. You and your neighbors and so on will have other varieties. But in Ireland, they didn't. Mm-hmm. And so when the genetics...
This is very complex stuff.
Let me back up. John Keegan sat in the same room and talked about something called professional deformation.
John Keegan is an historian
of war. And he's talking about seeing the world through the eyes of someone who studies war. You look at viruses. You've been involved with the hot viruses, the Hantavirus, the Ebola, and several of its manifestations, some near Washington, D.C. And it's real easy to treat this as the crisis du jour. The publicity has been fairly high. There have been some very popular books written. In a way, it looks like the population crisis of 20 years ago. And people look around today and say, well, we solved that. Is this just the crisis du jour, or is it going to get me? I mean, that's sort of the bottom line. That's what everybody wants to know.
Well, I think that you've got to see this in the long term. And I think that if you take a long-term perspective...
How long is long-term?
50 years. Then it's a serious problem. I mean, it's a very serious problem. And I think that when you talk about the population crisis being solved, I don't think it's solved. I think somebody got their numbers wrong, and it's going to come a little later than has been predicted. But we're getting closer and closer to that point. I mean, you can do the reductio ad absurdum. I mean, if there's one person on every square yard of the earth, it ain't going to be a good place. We have to stop before that. And there are certain places where you're headed in that direction, and where the population densities are incredibly intense. And those places, I think you have to wonder if they are going to come to us tomorrow and ask us to share our part of the earth with them because they haven't controlled their population situation. Now,
in a way, you represent the cure for that, though. It's not a pretty cure, but...
You as a virologist?
I mean, this is one of the four horsemen, plague and pestilence.
Yeah, but I think unless we can bring our civilization and our integration of the planet to a slightly higher level, we're going to see diseases arise that we may not be very happy with. I mean, HIV is a good example.
You mean brand new diseases?
Brand new diseases, sure. You have to look, if you take a historical perspective and you look back, and maybe this is not a very popular way to think, but you look back 5,000 years. We lived as little bands of hunter-gatherers. We didn't have diseases like measles. We didn't have polio. Because these diseases, these viruses that cause these diseases, have to have new hosts to hop to all the time. So if you have a small band of people in the middle of the Amazon forest or in the middle of the African forest or living in the steppes of Eurasia or in the small villages in Europe, anywhere in the world, there's not enough people in one place to provide new hosts for these viruses. It wasn't until about 5,000 years ago when in the Tigris-Euphrates basin we started to have substantial numbers of people who were brought together by irrigated agriculture, who built the great cities that we excavate today and read about in the Bible. And when this happened, viruses that were viruses of animals, and we were domesticating animals at that time, crossed over into humans and adapted to humans. So measles came about at that time. Measles then spread to Europe and later came to the Americas. Measles didn't come to the Americas until post-Columbian times. So these were new viruses, and I'm saying that it happened then and it can happen again.
There are two parts. I mean, it sounds like there are two parts. One is population density and the other is travel, connections between population centers, and we meet both standards pretty well now, don't we?
Meet or exceed.
Gee, that's encouraging. We're going to be back in a moment to see what we're going to do about all this with Dr. C.J. Peters. Bill Russell and I are with him at the Commerce Club in beautiful downtown
Atlanta. I am reminded of the story that they told me about what to do when you meet a grizzly bear.
Would you care to share that story,
No,
Bill?
But it doesn't look more hopeful. I hope it's more hopeful when we come back.
I hope so, too. Something about kissing
yourself goodbye,
yes. But we'll be back, and you can get yourself out of that box, Bill, in just a moment. Please stay with us. This is The Paula Gordon Show. Welcome back to The Paula Gordon Show. I am Paula Gordon. Bill Russell is here with me, and we're with Dr. C.J. Peters, who is the Chief of Special Pathogens at the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, here in Atlanta. You've also been in the military doing the same kind of thing, and you've been chasing hot viruses for 30 years.
Give or take.
Well, this is like chasing grizzly bears. Why would you do that? What got into you?
Would you care to finish the grizzly bear story, Bill?
Yeah, well, the idea is if everything else fails, you should assume the fetal position. Why you should do that is left to the reader as an exercise. What possessed you to go looking for trouble, put yourself in harm's way?
One of the advantages of being young is you don't worry about that.
You're so immortal. Stupid.
I started when I was young, and
by
the time I got older, we understood more about how to protect yourself.
But when you were young, this was unexplored territory, wasn't it?
Yes, and so we explored it. I mean, that's first, you're young, and second, you're a physician. And physicians don't believe that they're going to get sick. I mean, you're the doctor. You're not the patient. So
it's a rule.
That's right.
Well, I'm curious about that 30-year experience because in some ways it's part of what has lulled us into saying, oh, well, we fixed that. During that 30 years that you've been chasing hot viruses and during which time you've been a practicing physician and in the military as well as the civilian sector, we've made real progress, and I think that many people would say, well, you know, what's the problem? We've got technology. We'll fix it. You guys go solve this. You're a virologist. Isn't that the double-edged sword of the technology boom in the last 30 years? Of yes, we can fix it, but we've come to a point, well, maybe we can't fix it. Maybe we have lulled ourselves into a very scary place.
I think the I don't know, when I started doing this, I I had a vision that what we were doing is we were rewriting the chapters in the textbooks. And eventually we'd get all those chapters up to date, and they'd have, you know, prevention, treatment, and so on. Those sections would be complete, and then we could all retire. It doesn't work that way, because things come along that are new. They're either new, truly new, because they have represent a unique constellation of genes.
You mean like diseases being really new?
Yeah, a unique constellation of genes in a bug that's going to make us sick. Mm-hmm. Or they're new to us because we didn't know about them, or ecology didn't cause them to be a problem for us. The ecology was such that we didn't have that as a problem.
Is this like Ebola was fine when it was in the dense forest and it didn't get out?
Right, and as long as nobody went in there.
And nobody came out of there who was sick.
Nobody came out sick, and they didn't go to African hospitals that were too poor to afford clean, sterile needles and proper nursing equipment.
And then, they didn't then get on an airplane and fly to a major concentration of humans some other part of the planet.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so
isn't transportation a major element in this? The fact that we go every place on the planet?
Well, I think it's a transportation, not just of humans, but it's the speed with which humans move. I mean, you know, Livingston went back to London from the middle of what we called Zaire yesterday, and we're calling the Democratic Republic of the Congo today. And yet it took him weeks to do it. So he was not in an incubation period for many of these diseases. Today, a four-wheel drive vehicle and Air France to Paris will get you within striking distance of almost anywhere within an incubation period.
And we also can put monkeys on airplanes and send them to the other side of the world and spread diseases through other species.
Yes. And one of the things that's even more worrisome than monkeys, because in a way they're analogous to humans in that they're acutely infected and they move, but they're the little critters that carry these things. In other words, we can move mosquitoes around. So an African mosquito can be moved to the U.S., or an Asian mosquito can be moved to the U.S. Now, we may get away with only a temporary problem. There's a big difficulty around the world with a disease now that's called airport malaria. If you live near an airport, like particularly an airport like in Geneva, where there are Geneva, Switzerland, where there are many international flights, they land and the mosquito gets off, and the mosquito is infected with malaria from Africa or wherever the plane came from. And some poor Swiss guy who didn't even get to take a vacation abroad comes down with malaria and suffers with it. Well, it's not usually a long-term problem, because the malaria can be treated. The mosquitoes in Geneva are going to freeze that winter, so there's no long-term problem. But sometimes it's worse. For example, Aedes albopictus is an Asian mosquito.
Who is this?
He's called Aedes albopictus.
This is a mosquito person?
And he's an Asian mosquito. He's called the Asian tiger mosquito because he has little stripes. And he also bites humans like a tiger. And these have been brought to this country in shipments of tires for recapping, and they've established themselves. They now live here. They are an American mosquito. They will not be dislodged. We lost our chance when they came in because no one was far-sighted enough to say, we don't want a mosquito here that transmits a variety of diseases and loves to bite humans. So it was left, and it's now adapted to this country. It's begun to move north to areas where it couldn't have lived originally. It's undergone genetic change, Darwinian evolution. It's adapted. And this mosquito so far has not caused any problems. But, you know, it's only been here, a decade. We're already beginning to see that it may get mixed up in this cycle of Eastern encephalitis virus, the virus that's active in South Carolina now. So we are looking at this mosquito to see what kinds of problems it's going to complicate our life.
I was going through looking at what you do, and there's this concept of etiology, which I hadn't come across in a long time, causality, and going to the subtlety.
Etiology is at least a $10 word.
Yes, it is. Causality, looking for causes, and you have to pin down causes in order to do what you, in order to develop vaccines, in order to stop an epidemic, in order to figure out what causes that. You can't just do a hand wave and speculate.
Is that right?
He said it was.
Yeah, I know, but you're the guy who's supposed to
but
know.
See, my name's not on the show.
Okay. Yes, that's absolutely right. But there's a problem with what you mean by causality. I mean, cause, the first step, I think, in most of these situations, not always, but usually, is to find the infecting agent. And in we're talking about viruses, so I want to identify the virus that made you sick. But on the other hand, there's a whole spectrum of causes that surround that. And we were just talking about some of them. Say the virus is transmitted by a mosquito. Well, then I have to find out what mosquito transmits it. Why? How did that mosquito get here? Why did it bite you? Is it a mosquito that bit you because its preferred host for biting wasn't there? Or did you go to a place where you shouldn't have been? Or people didn't ordinarily go, and that brought you into harm's way, and so on. So there's a whole spectrum of causality that even includes, you know, nutrition and some of the other aspects. Why did you get so sick, or why did the other person not get so sick?
So these are, I hesitate to say, nonlinear systems. We're accustomed to thinking of causality as A causes B causes C, end of subject, and it's much more complex than that, much more subtle.
Absolutely, and you get into this, the whole situation with ecology, because many of our viruses, many of the viruses that I'm interested in and concerned with are viruses that are maintained in nature. They're floating around out there, and they depend on a vertebrate like a rodent or a bird or so on, plus perhaps an arthropod like a mosquito or a tick. Well, you take all the things that come together in terms of climate and vegetation to influence the behavior and the quantitative behavior of these different species. It's very complex. And, you know, I've...
Most people don't like complicated
things. It's complex and it's moving on you. It's not as if it's going to stay still. I mean, that's the problem with viruses. They change from minute to minute.
And, you know, we're coming up, for example, with an El Nino effect. This wind current, change in the ocean currents and so on. It's going to change the weather in North America next year. I mean, that's something that we can predict in the broad sense, but we don't know how this is going to impact on the diseases. We're very concerned, for example, with hantaviruses and rodents, because this El Nino brings you a warm winter, which means that the rodents will survive better over the winter, and it brings you rains, which means they're going to have lots of grass and grass seeds and so on the next year, and we may have problems with hantaviruses.
There's been a modest outbreak in Washington State recently, hasn't there?
Yes.
Which is not expected. Exactly. You may have expected it. It wasn't high on my list.
We expected it in the sense that we knew it would happen somewhere because it always does. But we didn't know when and we didn't know where. We're trying to understand some of those things. And I can't even... It's too complex, really, to get a handle on yet.
Dr. C.J. Peters is the chief of special pathogens at the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, that looks out for public health issues in the world now, not just in America. He is our guest. This is the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are here with a specially invited group of people at the Commerce Club. We hope you'll stay with us. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. We're talking with Dr. C.J. Peters, Bill Russell, and I here at the Commerce Club in Atlanta. Dr. Peters, we have not talked about your experience in the military, and that's really very important in one way because the way that we think about chemical and biological warfare is directly impacted by the very military nature of that exercise. I go directly from that to the concept of terrorism, which you seem to care a lot about. This is not a happy subject, but isn't it one that we need to be thinking about in the world at large when we talk about the power of these little bitty guys who are nothing more than RNA and DNA viruses, and the powerful impact it could have on our species at a time when there is lots of transportation available? These are little guys who are easy to transport. Isn't this an important subject for us to talk about, even though it's not a very happy one?
You know, biological terrorism is cheap. It's easy to put together. It costs a lot less and takes a lot less expertise than nuclear weapons. If you pick an agent that can be spread from person to person, it has a multiplier effect that can be a serious problem. So I think we've got to talk about it, and we've got to worry about it.
How do we do that without being alarmists? How do we do that and keep the volume down so that people just don't shut it all off?
good question, because I don't think we're really hitting the golden mean yet, because we have alarms like the Washington anthrax quote-unquote attack recently, where someone put something, scrawled anthrax spelled wrong on a piece of paper and scared everybody. But yet we don't have an appreciation that lasts more than the soundbite. The one thing that I think we have going for us is that there is some serious planning in the government. I'm
not at liberty to say too much about flashing neon sign over your head that says I can't talk about that part.
I don't know very much about some aspects of it. And but we've had the Nunn-Lugar bill, which has given money to municipalities so that first responders can train and understand how to deal with some of these problems.
A first responder is somebody in a hospital who's looking at patients? Is that what you mean by a first responder?
No, it could be a fire department. It could be the police. There has to be, once again, an integrated approach to this problem. You can't just say, okay, well, we'll make it CDC's responsibility, or we'll make it the Army's responsibility, because they're not in Washington, D.C. when the bell goes off. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to have the whole spectrum of response, including our civilian physicians. They have to be able to recognize anthrax and some of these other diseases.
And don't they now?
They're learning, but I couldn't when I got out of medical school, and I remembered a lot more then than I do now.
It's the photocopies. We've dodged the bullet on biological warfare, or at least we think we have, and I think that's probably lulled us. Biological warfare partly has not been used because it's so imprecise. It's so hard to target. And a terrorist has a different set of criteria. It doesn't, you know, you don't have the same command structure and you don't have the same objective. So
and they don't
mind
if they die.
Well, I don't think you have to die with just because you're working with biological agents. I mean, I'm here living proof that I've worked with some of the things that would make the greatest biological agents, and I'm perfectly fine. I think one of the reasons we're lucky in the terrorism aspect is, and I say this a little facetiously, microbiologists are such nice people. I mean, they very rarely reach the level of anger and frustration and disaffection that makes them want to do these things. Mm-hmm. And many of the people who have this kind of mindset are not going to go and take a PhD in microbiology. They're going to find some friends that will show them how to make explosives. So I think that echoes really, I think, off what you said about the generals and biological warfare. Is the doctrine is not there. The generals are not accustomed to thinking about it. And I'm sure you mentioned Keegan, having been on this program, I'm sure that he would argue that that's just not the way a real general fights a war today. But there are uses for these weapons, and they will work. I mean, they have not been deployed extensively, but the background behind them says that they will work. The U.S. military, and I'm not trumpeting this, but they did a number of tests of surrogate organisms in the New York subway using spores that would have simulated anthrax, and using Serratia marcescens, which is a bacterium that's
a
mouthful.
Thank you.
That they sprayed off the coast of California as a surrogate for
plague.
That was
a long time ago, too, it's worth
that
saying.
Thank you. It was in the 60s, and it was before
alerted to some of the ethical issues around this.
But in any case, they will work. There's no question.
And at the very least, should we not be responsible in what you talk about as surveillance, in just paying attention? Well, don't you make the same argument both for the wild viruses and for these kinds of biological agents used in military applications, that we need to just be paying attention?
You bet.
Are we doing that?
I think we're moving in that direction. For example,
on both the military and the wild virus kinds of fronts?
Oh, yeah.
Fronts?
The military got
Can
a
I sleep
real...
tonight, please?
Can you wake up in the morning is a question.
I think the military got a real jolt during Desert Storm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I worked in a research institute that was concerned with biological warfare defense. So we were thinking about all these things, and we were trying to tell people, hey, listen, there's a real problem. And when Desert Storm came, there was a real problem, and we were not prepared. We had the outline and the skeleton down, but we were not prepared. The doctrine for dealing with these problems was not out there. People were not vaccinated. Vaccines existed for some of the things, but they hadn't been updated. And all that is changing in the military. Not perhaps as fast as it might, but it's changing.
Well, and part of that, we tend to be short-term oriented, and a lot of this requires preparation. It requires that research be done that doesn't have any instantaneous payoff.
You also have a great line about apple trees, and I'll probably scramble it, so I'll let you do it. But isn't that what we're talking about?
Yeah.
Would you care to explain apple trees, please?
We're talking about apple trees. You're a botanist, aren't you?
No. Yeah.
Amateur at times. The thing, I guess what I tried to say is people will let a research capability wither, and then they'll come and they'll say, we've got to have this. We need this now. How much money do you need? And the answer is, I don't need money. I mean, I need money, but what we need is time to train people, time to bring people along, to get them to acquire the knowledge base and so on. And the analogy that I always use is, if you want apples, you're going to have to plant apple trees and wait for them to bear fruit. You can't get your apples any faster by planting a whole orchard than you can by planting one tree. So you have to start ahead of time.
The analogy is very apt because I can get an apple anytime. All I have to do is go to the store and buy it.
Go to the store and buy it, yeah.
That's right.
And I think that's probably our mindset.
So are we planting apple trees?
We're planting a small stand of apple trees. I might wish for a larger orchard, but you know, those are social issues. We only have so much money to spend. And so I'm not going to beat on the desk and say we're all going to die because we're not doing more research on this. But I think that the current trend in responses to emerging infections, in responses to biological terrorism, and in readiness for biological warfare has got to continue. We can't just drop it. It's got to continue to grow, and it's got to continue to be regarded seriously, or we are going to be in real trouble.
Are we committing adequate resources? Not to put you on the spot, but to put you on the spot.
And this is a political issue. You're a political animal as well as a doctor and a virologist, aren't you?
I'm just a poor guy from West Texas who's trying to get along here in Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay, in addition to that.
I'm going to read you a line from your book. Within the safe confines of USAMRIID, for which I'm sure there's an acronym.
That has something to do with the Army.
I learned how to maintain my autonomy and get things accomplished within the bureaucracy. Now, of all the things you've talked about, that's the most miraculous.
Well, I may have been exaggerating.
These are political, social issues, aren't they?
One of the things that I found useful in getting along in the bureaucracy is that I'm not intensely ambitious for power or position, except I want to be able to do the things that I think are fun and important, and that sometimes you get left alone. But I think these are political issues, and I think we've got to keep pushing to keep the amount of effort that's going into this continually ramping up. I don't think we've reached the plateau that we want to be on yet.
Our guest is Dr. C.J. Peters. Bill Russell and I are with him here at the Commerce Club with a small invited audience, and the rest of the Commerce Club has a larger invited audience. We're glad to be here in vibrant downtown Atlanta. We're going to be back in just a moment with Dr. Peters. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Dr. C.J. Peters is our guest. He is the Chief of Special Pathogens. That's a mouthful. At the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control here in Atlanta. There, in America, it seems that we want a cure for death. It's your line. I stole it directly out of your book, which is a wonderful book about hunting viruses. Isn't that just wrong? We're not going to beat death.
No, but we'd like to have a little more control over when we go and how we go. And I think that's a viable goal. That's something I'm in favor of.
In the face of the kind of terrorist acts that we have seen in the last decade, sarin in the Tokyo subways, the threats that came out of Desert, the threats at least, that came out of Desert Storm, Desert Shield. There's a lot going on that has death written with a big D in ways that people probably want to go into deep denial about. Isn't it part of your job to make it possible for us to come out of denial and deal with these things? Or is that something we have to do and you just tell us how to get there?
I think what I try to do in that book is tell you that there is a problem out there, that you should be able to sleep at night, but when you wake up, you ought to worry just a little bit, and you ought to get some insurance. I mean, the guys
insurance like what?
Well, insurance like surveillance, research, the counterterrorist effort, not begrudge the military the means that they need to go on and develop their countermeasures against biological warfare as well as chemical and nuclear. In other words, some of these problems we can nip earlier rather than later. We're saddled now in my group with a set of regulations over shipping viruses.
We the CDC,
everybody in the research community. They're difficult. They cost us money. They cost us time. But we believe in them because
the regulations
keep,
do, or the viruses cost us?
We believe the regulations cost us money.
Uh-huh.
But we do it because we think it's important that there's control over these viruses. People live with these regulations, and these are recent regulations that have come about after some guy wrote up and tried to order some plague to work with.
You mean
with.
Like bubonic plague?
Yeah, he wanted to order some plague from one of the culture collections so that he could work with it in his garage. And he was a very disaffected young gentleman who...
Just some guy?
Yeah. And
I'm not going to sleep tonight.
Well, it's been fixed.
Thank you.
At least the one we know about.
This whole process has changed, and so you can't just get it out of the Sears and Roebuck catalog anymore. But it still is, we're making progress in those areas, and we don't like it as a community because it burdens microbiologists. Mm-hmm. But we know we've got to do it, and so we're doing some of those things.
Mm-hmm. I tend to think, say hot viruses, I think exotic, and you brought me up short with the flu epidemic.
One of 1918?
In 1918.
Yeah.
I mean, that killed a lot of people, and that, we have not fixed that, have we? That is symptomatic of the kinds of things we could deal with.
We're still at risk, and we're still overdue. We still, I shouldn't say...
Overdue for what?
Overdue for a flu epidemic. We're overdue for a large flu epidemic that'll sweep the world. Flu changes from year to year, and so every year we make a new vaccine for it. But every decade, we used to say, every decade or so, it swaps a major gene for a new one. And then it comes on the world as a brand new plague and goes over the whole world.
What's the problem?
Because it's last year's flu shot.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Always last year's flu shot, isn't it?
Yeah. It's always. Now, sometimes we're lucky and it's 80 or 90% effective. Sometimes we're not and it's dishwater. So we have to try to keep ahead of the flu, but it's going to come as a pandemic.
This is all world issues, isn't it? This is a global job.
Well, you said
in.
The magic word. You said pandemic.
Yeah, there's nothing local about any of these diseases. They can be local problems today, but tomorrow, and it ain't necessarily going to be local.
And some of these are truly hideous diseases. I mean, the flu is the flu, and it kills you, but some of the stuff you
maybe
talk about...
Well, your specialty is hemorrhagic fevers.
That's right. And the blood
That's
always
ugly
looks
stuff,
gory.
Isn't it?
It sounds worse than it is. I mean, there's no good way to die. I mean, I don't think that any of these diseases that kill you are good ways to go.
One of the things we try, sub-themes in this program, is not to sit passively as the world operates on us. Is there something we should be doing or supporting you or hiding under our beds or wearing masks?
Give me some good news here.
I think...
What can I do to survive, doctor?
I think one of the things that we really overlook is the role of the local and state health departments. I mean, I know this sounds like apple pie and mother, but it's true. And these people are being stressed to an extreme degree. They're having to deal with HIV. They're having to deal with budget cuts and so on and so on. And these are the people who make sure that there's no rat urine in the restaurant where you're eating. They make sure that you have the protection against these diseases. I don't do surveillance in the sense of going out and looking in Atlanta, Georgia, even to see if anybody has hemorrhagic fever. Your local health department will find it. your local physician will call the local health department. They'll contact the state health department. And if they can't handle it, they'll contact us.
And if they don't find it, we're in deep sneakers.
They'll be, the cat will be out of the bag.
So is it good news or bad news?
I think it's mixed. I mean, I think we finally woke up. I've seen these things happening, as I said, for 30 years, and I didn't realize until the last decade or so, hey, all this new stuff is coming along, and every time we dodge a bullet, mm-hmm. sooner or later we're not going to dodge the bullet. Mm-hmm. And now in the last 5 years, I think people, 3 to 5 years, people have begun to really wake up and say, there is a problem.
Well, and if two bullets are fired at once, and that's what you're saying, we just don't have the resources. I mean, we're spread very thinly already.
Absolutely.
And there is an opportunity here.
An opportunity to spend some money that you'll get return on.
Dr. C.J. Peters, my goodness, what a great wealth of opportunity you have given us. Thank you for being our guest.
Dr. Peters' book, Virus Hunter, is published by Anchor Books. You can link to Dr. Peters' webpage for Virus Hunter from our webpage. You'll find us on the internet, both in real audio and text, at www.thepaulagordonshow.com. And yes, The Paula Gordon Show is all one word. We thank Dr. Peters and his colleagues for all that they are doing. I'm Paula Gordon. I wish you well.